last nice warm day before the temperatures plunge. I guess the front comes through tomorrow. If you're visiting with us tonight, we're glad to see you. Glad you're here. Invite you to join our study. We're in the life of Christ. This is lesson 12, so we're kind of up into it. Sunday, we'll have Matthew 5, 6, and 7. All in one class. I know there's been books written on that, so we're going to cover the whole thing in 40 minutes. So it'll be kind of sit through it in a hurry. So read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It'll take you about less than 20 minutes to read it. If you'll read it a time or two between now and Sunday, that'd be great. We'll get started on that. So tonight, as we get into our review of what we did Sunday, a little bit before we get into tonight's class. Tonight's class is really short. What we've got really toward the end is the name of the 12 apostles. That's about all there is in this class. So I want to go back through Sunday's review like we normally do, except I'm going to slow down in a couple of places that I've added a couple of slides in. So a couple of points I'd like to make that I did not make Sunday. So we'll go through the review and throw a couple of new things in, and then get into tonight's lesson about the calling of the 12. So don't forget to keep these in your mind, the seven periods that we divide life's Christ, the life of Christ into, beginning the ministry, the 30 years up to the time of his baptism. We've already been through that. It's not much there detail-wise. The beginning of his ministry lasted about 6 months, and now we're actually into this great Galilean ministry, or the time he spends in Galilee. Tonight, we'll see him go on preaching tours and things like that as we get into that. But it kind of puts the time frame where we are. So we got 18 months. This is the longest period of his ministry time here. looking at some maps, we haven't done this in a while to kind of see where we are. After he had been in Jerusalem, he goes back up to Galilee and goes to Cana, where he did his first miracle, water to wine. And there, the nobleman's son, nobleman's in Capernaum, comes over to him and asks him to heal his son. He does, and then he goes down to Nazareth, which is his hometown, where he's reads this prophecy in the synagogue on the Sabbath and said, just talking about me, and they try to kill him, reject him. So he goes up to Capernaum, make that kind of his headquarters, his home, if you will, from there, and several things there. Then he goes out on a preaching tour in Galilee. So we need to go out and preach to the villages around about. So he goes on this first preaching tour of Galilee. Then he goes back to Capernaum for a while, and various events occur there. And that's kind of where we are right now with this part. Then we'll see him go down to Jerusalem here a little bit later on in the lesson tonight. Oops. Starting off tonight, looking at the review from Sunday, we had this thing about fasting. The people wanted to know why John's disciples fast and the Pharisees' disciples fast, or the Pharisees themselves fast, but your disciples don't fast. And so Jesus, of course, we talk about fast. It is part of the law under certain circumstances, but it's not the way that they have put it in their customs and traditions, where you fast twice a week. And the Pharisee in Luke 18, we talked about the comparison to the sinner praying and the Pharisee praying, boasting about I fast twice a week. That's nowhere in the law. That's Pharisee custom, or the custom that we'll talk about those customs in just a minute. So Jesus tells them that it's not now's the time to fast. There'll be time to fast when I'm gone. And he uses the bridegroom, for example. You don't fast while the bridegroom is with you. That's when the feast is going on. And so he was there with them. His disciples will maybe fast later, but not now. He did their attention for other things. And then they go into the grain fields again on the Sabbath. And all this stuff is Sabbath day stuff. That's what's causing the Jews to get so upset. And they're walking through the grain fields, and they pluck grain. And they take it, rub it in their hands, and they eat, they get the husk off, and they eat the grain. And the Pharisees then accuse them of breaking the law of the Sabbath. So that law would be no work on the Sabbath. Well, first thing is to know that they did not violate the law. But Christ is with them. He had no sin. He would not violate the law. So they were breaking, again, Jewish custom. And the examples he brings up, that of David eating the showbread, and the priests working on the Sabbath in order to offer sacrifices. They have to do their work to the sacrifices. And I'm sorry, I got a frog. Back on this point here about David and law of mercy being extended to him, where it was okay for him to eat that the showbread that they reserved for the priest. But I get into all big discussion about that. This incident is used by many people to justify, this new slide was not here Sunday, to justify doing what I think needs to be done under a given set of circumstances. Something that's normally referred to as situation or situational ethics, which is right because of this circumstance. And that's what they use in this passage here from David. And one line I was reading even went as far as say, it's okay for a man and woman to divorce if they can't get along and they're happier not together, because Jesus wants everybody to be happy and not live in an unhappy situation. Again, the situation demands that it's okay to divorce, was this particular writer's thing. Now, that would seem, I guess, I'm trying to find a good word to use, silly or crazy or stupid or whatever to us. I mean, I think any of us would think about saying it's okay to divorce because of this particular situation, because Jesus wants everybody to be happy. I mean, we would think about that. Yet, I know a person right now, a person that some of you would know if I call their name, I think, attends a, what we would call a sound church. Thank you very much, sir. A sound church that has said, and they did not use this particular passage here to justify it, but use some verses in 1 Corinthians 7, 10 and 11, to justify this same exact point. That if a couple cannot get along together, and they're happier divorced or separated, then that's what they ought to do. So it's not really as far-fetched to some people as we might think. There are people, like I said, some of you would know this person, so it's not as far away from us as you might think. The people taking a particular situation and saying, oh, I can use this scripture to say that's okay in this particular case here. Which is, it goes back to what this, so many people who preach this situation ethics thing, it's okay under a given situation, use this passage to justify it. Okay, that makes sense. I follow that. So, the point we talked about Sunday and this whole thing here was, we make judgments. We need to be careful to understand the basis of our judgment. Are we using the scriptures correctly to base our judgment on? The Pharisees were not, obviously, in this case here. Yes, sir, Mike. Sorry. Yeah. It cost him his life. He would have done it just frivolously anyhow. Right. It cost all the priests their life when Doeg testified against them there. Yeah. Yeah. Good. What Mike's saying is, the fellow I hear him over here, is that before Ahimelech gave David that showbread that was reserved for the priest, he inquired the Lord about doing it before he did it. Okay, so it wasn't just a, oh, okay, I'll think it's okay to do that type thing here. Okay. All right, taking that point about the Jewish customs, the traditions of the rabbis, the Pharisees, and their laws. Let's talk about it in just a minute. And this comes, these couple of points here come from Bob's book. One of the laws said that you would bear no burden on the Sabbath day. And it's referenced in Jeremiah 17. It's also in Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments, that you will keep the Sabbath day holy, there'll be no work done on it, etc. So that was definitely a law of the Jews. No work on the Sabbath. So Bob points out that they had these, where they classified all these laws. If your house catches fire on the Sabbath, you can save those things that would be pertinent to you keeping the Sabbath law. So if there's something in your house you needed in order to keep the Sabbath law, you could save that from the house fire. But other things you couldn't save because they'd be working on the Sabbath, which would be against the Sabbath law. But you could also save the clothes you're wearing. So you could go in the house, put on all the clothes you could that you could get on, go outside, take them off because you were wearing the clothes out of the house. And then what you got off there, you could go back in and repeat the same process. Put on clothes again, wear them out, take them off, because that was okay. You weren't working. You were just saving the clothes on your back. So that's how to us ridiculous some of these things were. And the next one is even worse. Wearing a bandage. If you had an injury, a wound, if that wound required a bandage to avoid bleeding, a bandage was necessary to avoid bleeding, we could wear a bandage. If it wasn't necessary to avoid bleeding, then wearing that bandage on the Sabbath would be work. You're carrying an extra, you're bearing a burden. You're carrying a burden on your body that you shouldn't be carrying. So that's some of the tradition type things here that's gotten into all these rules and regulations of these Pharisees. I got a couple of quotes here about this. So the bottom line is the most significant issue of the law were lost in the trivial details of the Pharisaic tradition. Keeping the law as it's supposed to be kept was lost. And all of these little traditions that the rabbis and the Pharisees tacked onto it. And then this one is even, to me, better as applying to us. Since there are times we come up against some of the same challenges, and we would do well to remember what Jesus told the Pharisees. Binding traditions and rules hinders us from finding God's guidance according to God's attitude. But be careful. When we see the Pharisees and others, we should first make sure we have expelled the Pharisees and ourselves. Let us not bind traditions with adding to or taking away from God's word. Let's seek to do God's will only. So the challenge there to us is to be careful that we don't bind things on somebody. Now, I'm going to use an example. It's going to blow your mind out. That's okay. Here we go. Modern day example. Okay. For illustration purposes only. Not advocating any change. For illustration purposes only. Some congregations have done away with the Sunday evening service. They go on Sunday. They go and assemble on Sunday morning only. Okay. Okay. What would our tradition say? How many people have a fit about it? Some people argue that, Mike. Okay. Now, how about adding this thought to it? It's okay if we take that hour at night and tack it on to Sunday morning. Because we have to get our 2 hours Sunday morning, 1 hour Sunday night, 1 hour Wednesday night. We have to get our 4 hours a weekend, right? So it's okay to tuck out Sunday night as long as we put that hour on Sunday morning. Law or tradition? So we have to be careful we don't bind our back ourselves to these, some of these same corners like that. Okay. Now, I'm not advocating we make this change. It was strictly for illustration purposes, okay? But if we did that, there'd be a lot of people who would find a place to go every Sunday night because I've got to go on Sunday night. Okay? So, comments? Anybody have questions, thoughts about that? I know I was turning some stuff up.
You can't let your mouth because there could be some people who go, you know what, I want to go worship God whenever I have an opportunity. So you have to be careful.
As long as it's that and not and going because I'm bound to the tradition. Okay, that's my point. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. They were guiltless, right, yes.
It's not that they were guiltless.
Right. Yes. Yeah, bottom point. God made the Sabbath man to rest. God is the Lord of the Sabbath, right above it. Okay. Yes, I totally agree. Brent. Thank you. Okay, let me get back past all this and move on to some new stuff here. Okay, Jesus gets ready now. He's going to get on the Sabbath and go heal a man with a withered hand. Now, the Jews are watching very closely. Why? to hear what he's going to teach, to hear what he's going to say. No, they want to see if he's going to heal the man on the Sabbath. So they're watching for him so they can find something wrong with him. And I made the point Sunday. I've talked to a man one time who was doing that same thing today. This has been, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. I don't remember, but anyhow. So I can't listen to the preacher because I'm listening, trying to hear him make a mistake when I hear preaching. Well, what they were doing, they were watching Jesus make a mistake. So you ask him a question. If you have a sheep that falls in a pit on the Sabbath, are you going to get it out? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? Okay. And it says Jesus was grieved because they wanted to persecute him instead of listening to this teaching and observe the signs he was doing and believe in what he was teaching. Okay. So now he finishes all that up in Capernaum, goes down to Jerusalem now. And we get into John chapter 5, where we spend a lot of time. We're going to step on through this right quick. Some feast in Jerusalem, don't know what feast. Man's at the pool of Bethesda, been there 38 years, lame, cannot get in the pool when the water is stirred to be healed. So Jesus asked him if you want to be healed. He says, tell him to rise, take up your bed, and walk. Now, they were not there. We have a record of the Jews being there when Jesus healed him. That's not the point this time about healing on the Sabbath. That's not the point. The point here is what Jesus told him to do. Rise, take up your bed, and walk. Okay? Because when the Jews see him carrying his bed on the Sabbath, that's work. And so they got on to him about that. And here's the verse that Brent mentioned earlier. One of them is that the Son of Man's the Lord of the Sabbath. Okay. He knew what the law was on the Sabbath. Would he cause this man to sin? Would he tell him to take up his bed and walk? Well, of course not. So they keep on trying to kill him. Okay. Then we get this thing about him being my father, the personal father. He broke the Sabbath and now he's equating himself with God. And Jesus spends the rest of the chapter trying to get them to understand who he is and why they should honor the Son as they honor the Father. Witnesses, John the Baptist bore witness of him. His works, the miracles he did, bore witness of him. And, of course, God bore witness of him when he spoke to him at the baptism. So he said, you search the Scriptures trying to find eternal life, and but you miss me being in the Scriptures. I'm there, and you won't see that. And we talk about this point here. When we're seeking the Scriptures, we need to look for Christ and make sure we find him and not just memorize Scripture. And there's a passage from John 17 where Jesus wants his disciples to be one in unity. He references him and his Father as being one. That's the example he uses to base this on, the oneness there. Okay, I'm sorry it takes so long, but a couple of new slides there. Now, we're in Matthew chapter 12. Down further, verse 15, where this starts, and there's parallels in some of the others. And the Jews are still looking to destroy him. And one reference said that destroy here is not the word annihilate, but we already have references of them wanting to kill him, so I don't remember why that difference was pointed out there. But because of this, Jesus withdraws from them. But the multitudes follow him. And best I can tell, he withdraws from those who are seeking to kill him, gets away from them, even though the multitudes of the people that wanted to hear him, they fall in there with it. His popularity, again, before that, is very, very high. It's going to start a downhill climb here for too long. He heals all the people that are with him there, and he tells them, don't make me known. Don't go talk about it. Well, with a multitude of people there, that takes a little thought to figure out, what do you mean, don't talk about it? When everybody's seeing it. Well, I think he does try not to get the word again too much back to those who are seeking to kill him, because are they going to try to kill him before his time is ready? I don't know, but I don't understand exactly why he would say, don't make this known when there are multitudes of people there seeing it. Okay. So now we have this prophecy from Isaiah chapter 42 that Matthew uses in his text of Trent, you want to read that for us? Matthew 42, 1 through 4. And it's almost the same prophecy as listed here in Matthew chapter 12. If Brent's going to read it from Isaiah. Trent, excuse me. Okay. This same thing is quoted in Matthew chapter 12 here, almost the whole thing here. The reference to someone Isaiah is talking about, referred to as my servant, someone in whom I am well pleased. We think about at least two occasions where that statement is made about Jesus at his baptism, and of course we haven't got there yet, the transfiguration. The prophet said he would show judgment to the Gentiles. Guidance was another word that I found equated in here to that. The Gentiles, keep in mind, in the past had been forbidden. They were not part of the law. But something new is coming where he will bring the Gentiles into it. He will come in a different manner from what John did. He's not going to be like John, loud crying out, the voice of one crying in the wilderness. But Jesus comes in a meek and lowly type approach. There's this point here about not breaking a bruised reed or quenching the smoking flax. Bruised reed is used often to talk about those who are weak, those who are unstable. Those people would be rejected by the religious elite. The Pharisees would not want someone like that around them, but not by Jesus. That's the very people he calls into him. The smoking flax, if you think about a wick in a pot of oil or a container of oil they use for a lamp, the wick there, when the oil is all gone, then that flax, that wick is going to start smoking and burning because it's now burning it instead of the oil. And so he says he won't quench that. He, again, it represents weakness because the oil is all gone. What's Jesus going to do? He's going to put fresh oil in. He's going to fit it up. He's not going to quench that smoking flax. His name, the Gentiles will trust. Trust, hope. Romans 5, the God of hope. Matthew is the only one that uses that quotation there from Isaiah. But moving on now, Jesus prays all night because he has this, and these are my words here, this super important event coming up. Jesus is going to take his disciples being a follower, and he's going to pull some of them together, and from them, he's going to name his 12 apostles. Okay, so these are the people who he's going to entrust to take his teaching and spread it after his death. So, big, major thing. These ones will be with him. He'll send him out to preach. He's going to give him miraculous powers, specifically mentioned here. Then here are the names. And I think Matthew, Mark, and Luke all list the names of the 12 here, some in a little different order from what the others are. Many of you, I assume, memorized these at some point in your life. Most of us can rattle them off pretty fast if you did that. The sheet, one of the sheets I passed out to you at the very beginning, it's got the 12 apostles listed on it and some things about them from New Testament and then from history, how they died. So you might get that sheet and look back at it sometime if you got time to think about it in a minute. And of course, there are two others that are not on this list that specifically are mentioned as apostles. When Judas had died, one had to take his place. And then, of course, Paul was a special apostle. But there are others that are mentioned as apostles. Barnabas is called an apostle, but not, I don't think, in the same manner as these are. So let's talk about apostles for a minute. What are apostles? Messengers commissioned by some commissioning agent, some person, to go on a mission, to follow the instructions of that person who sent them out, their messengers. In this case, they're appointed by Christ for a special function in the church. When they go to appoint Matthias, they talk about what one would have to do in order to be an apostle, someone who had been with us from the beginning and a witness to the resurrection. Those points are made there. So, be a witness to the resurrection and commissioned and empowered to go out on this mission that Crossville Cinema, which, of course, Matthew 28, the Great Commission, gave his apostles right before he ascended. Now, let's look at Ephesians chapter 2 for a minute. And he's going to read these verses 19 through 22. There's four verses here. And we'll pick out really one verse and talk about it, because it mentions the apostles specifically. But man, to read all four of those verses. Okay. Jesus' followers are illustrated by several different things in the New Testament. A body, a building, citizens in the kingdom, a number of things like that. Here, it's a building. And you're built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Jesus being the chief cornerstone. In building, and we don't think about it so much now in building, but in them, where they used big stones to build walls out of, you've seen pictures of the temple, things like this. The cornerstone was that stone at which the entire structure was based on. Every stone laid was laid in proximity to or based upon the angles or the whatever of the cornerstone. Y'all may have seen some of that with some of your work that you've done. But everything's in relation to the cornerstone. Jesus is the cornerstone in this verse here, the chief cornerstone. But it's on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. So how is that? How do the apostles, these men we just studied, read here, who they were, Jesus called them, how does it affect us? What is Ephesians 2:20 talking about when it says the foundation of the apostles and prophets? The apostles are the ones who are going to reveal, as I said earlier, Jesus is going to send them on this on the mission. They're his ambassadors, if you will. The apostles are the ones who's going to make him known to the world. So how's he going to do that? Well, they do that starting in Acts chapter 2 with a sermon preached that time. But that's just part of it. We see other references through there, like in Acts 2:42, they contend in the apostles' doctrine. Well, of course, the word doctrine just means teaching. So the apostles were there. But even thinking beyond that, how are we affected by the apostles' foundation today? What do we read from? What do we read from? Their writings, their teachings, right? So as Christ would teach them, and they deliver that message to us, the very foundation from which we get our teaching, done from these apostles and prophets. So we're affected even today by the teaching of these 12, the apostles there. What evidence of conversion is a desire? Now keep in mind, this is in Acts 2 where they just had this first sermon and these 3,000 people responded to it. The statement here is something I read tied to that. What evidence of conversion is a desire to be instructed in the doctrines and the teachings and duties of Christ and a willingness to attend to the preaching of the gospel? If I am truly converted, if I am truly converted, what am I hungry for? What am I wanting to hear? What am I anxious to hear? More. Yeah. More. I want the story. Tell me more about Jesus. Relate more of the story to me. Give me more of the apostles' doctrine. Give me more of the apostles' teachings as they would present Christ. So if I am truly converted, I want more. I want more and more of it. Okay. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I bumped it again. They were Peter, Andrew, James, John. Yeah. Yes. They're the only we have for apostles. I'm going to slide in a minute about this. Do we have apostles today? We'll just try right back to that. But yeah, Bill said, you know, that the Mormons have their apostles today, and they were asking Bill, Do you have apostles today? Yeah, Bill said, yeah, sure we do. Peter, Andrew, James, John, he started naming them out. 1 Corinthians 3:10. According to the grace of God, which is given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation. This is Paul, the same foundation we're talking about. He said, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. Which Paul had been there preaching, and now someone else will come in and after he leaves and preach and build on his foundation. Okay? But look what he says here. I think this is something we need to think about. That each one of you take heed how you build on it. What did Paul tell them? I don't remember the reference, I'm sorry. About the gospel I've preached to you versus any other gospel. If you're teaching any other gospel, what? Let it be accursed. Okay? Paul had laid this foundation, and he didn't want somebody else to come in and put something else on top of it that wasn't true. So as we think about what we teach, and we're teaching on top of that foundation that has been laid already, based on the apostles, we've been careful about that we don't put something else on top of it that's going to mess the building up. Now, back to Brent's point over here. Do we have apostles today? I like Bill's answer. Yes, and he goes back to these apostles here. We read that when the New Testament church was guided by the apostles as it got started, right? A lot about the apostles is I meant to go back and just do a word search how many times the word apostles is in the book of Acts. I never did do it. But yeah, all through the book of Acts, the apostles were there. Acts 15, when the question came up, who did they go to Jerusalem to see? The elders and the apostles? Okay. We have their written instructions today. So we have apostles today through their written instruction. Now, I think the next point here is one I'll think about. Yeah. Jesus told them in Luke 16, this is with Lazarus, the rich man, when they wanted to send back someone to speak to his brothers, remember them? What did Jesus tell them? They have what? Moses and the prophets. Remember that? They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. How did they have Moses and the prophets here in Jesus' time? Moses had been dead for years. What did they have? They had their instructions, right? They have what was revealed to Moses as he wrote down from God the law. How'd they have Moses and the prophets? They have what they had taught. How do we have the apostles today? Same way. Okay? So do we have apostles? Yeah. We have their teaching. And we follow their teaching as they was delivered to them by Christ. Was delivered to him by his Father. And I thought this was a good example. They didn't have Moses at that time when Christ told them to have Moses the prophet, little bit to them. They didn't have them there physically there. They were gone. They were dead. Then a 400-year gap here with no word from God. But God said, Christ told them, you have Moses and the prophets. Come listen to them. We have the apostles today the same way. We have their instructions. We have their written word. Okay. Somebody else. Thoughts?
I was just trying to figure out what a latter-day apostle will benefit them.
I don't know. I'm not a detailed guy on the other religions, the Mormons or whoever. They get their word through the prophet, Joseph Smith or whatever. I don't know what the apostles do for them today. I don't think they receive revelation necessarily.
It's my understanding.
Which goes to 1 Corinthians 13. Yeah. Somebody else? The big thing about this, though, last night was the calling of the 12. Of course, I don't want to minimize it at all. It was a very, very important event. Jesus prayed for a long time about how it was going to work because of the impact it has on us today. Selection of these 12 was important to him. All right, Sunday, like I said, read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. If you can, two or three times. We'll try to pick out a summary, highlights. Like I said, there have been sermons preached on verse, one or two verses out of it. There have been books written about the Sermon on the Mount, so we can't dive into all of it that's there in a 40-minute class Sunday morning. But we will go into it and get an overall picture of what Christ is teaching there. This is, think about it being a long, long sermon. Like I said, you can sit down and read it in about 15 to 18 minutes, just reading through it. It's not really as long as Steve would preach on Sunday morning. Think about it. All right, thanks.